for Hip Hop Express at 6, Blues Live at 8, and The Bachelor Pad at 10. This is Smile Politely Radio. SmilePolitely.com is the place to go for all things local arts, culture, food and drink, music, opinion, and so much more. I'm joined in the studio today by Josh, co-host. Josh, how are you, Josh?
I'm doing real well.
That's awesome on this kind of gloomy, rainy, Champaign-Urbana kind of day. And we are also joined by Matt Minicucci, famous poet, world-renowned.
Not true at all. I love that you said it. Thank you.
Winner of many awards and a lecturer in the Department of English at the University of Illinois, whose book, Translations, came out on Kent State University Press and won the WIC Poetry First Book Prize this very year in 2015.
This very year. Well, I guess technically 2014, but it takes like a year and a half for any book to occur, evidently.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And so we're going to talk poetry today, and we're going to also hear some poems. And to get us started, you were telling us before the show that you have a poem up on Poetry Daily.
Absolutely.
Do you want to tell us a little about that and let us hear it?
Yeah. This is a poem that originally appeared actually in the Kenyon Review, and is up on Poetry Daily just today. So it seemed like providence. Figured it was worth reading. So and thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
It's called Book 25. What if it's said like this? A man leaves. He takes with him all he can carry. What spoils he has slip through the cracks of 100 road ships. What songs are sung, sing only of distant homes. In this story, fires live only in hearths. They light and cook and forget the golden locks that might fuel them. Steel goes unwielded, skin collects dust. In this story, you live, and each morning brings new words. Moments of arcing breath translated, old lovers coiled like glide vows. Here, we forget the long fight, the loss, the ground torn like wind whip banners. Here, there are only two men, one a poor horseman, and the other a handsome prince. They run for miles each night. They sleep, clothed only by a single strap of stars, far from the shield story, but close enough to forget the armor they bear.
I love your imagery in that.
Could you tell us a little bit about how that poem fits into the book as a whole, and a little bit about translations, what kind of book it is, and
sure.
what it concerns?
I actually got a really interesting email just today that was from a teacher in Nebraska who had seen the poem and read it to his students, his high school AP English students. And they had all these theories about what the poem meant, which I thought was quite lovely. And I almost didn't want to have my own explanation for it, because I liked the theories more than maybe my explanation. But the poem, the book 25 portion of it, is referencing Homeric epic always has 24 books. So my feeling was, what would the 25th book was the impossible book. What if the impossible happened? What if, instead of all these things, say in the Iliad, what if he had just left? What if Achilles had just left? What would have happened then? You know? So I think there's a lot of thought of that. But the book itself, translation, I never thought I would be talking, certainly on the radio with you.
I know you've made it to WEFT. That's the peak of fame.
Exactly. But I talk about it every reading I go to. I never thought I would be talking about poetry. I thought I'd be sitting in a room translating Greek. But I wasn't very good at it, as it turned out. It was hard. Oh, it was so hard. But I never forgot how important all those themes were. I never forgot how important the stories were, the teachers that I had, all that. Always been fascinated with etymologies, always been fascinated with all that stuff. So the translation in the book is very much classical allusion. It's also very much the speaker translating a lot of things into sort of, I think, as I believe Jane Hirschfield said in her introduction, navigable vessels of inner life, which is, I don't know exactly what it means, but very lovely of her to say. So, yeah.
Well, you know, you're alluding to ancient writings that create these archetypes that have the heroic story, what the epic is, that carries on from everything through Cinderella to Star Wars, absolutely, everything that we listen to today. So the fact that that has, and it directly ties to the expression of the inner vessels, is, it's very applicable. And absolutely. And like, and the imagery, you know, myself, I write fantasy fiction. So, the imagery you're using and the idea of the 25th chapter of a Homeric epic, I really love that, the hero getting home kind of idea.
Finally, yeah.
So I wanted to ask you what it is like being read and interpreted.
Oh, man, that's such a great question. Such an evil question. Can we talk about the new Star Wars trailer?
No, I mean, because, you know, I think about this as somebody that is in literary studies. We say all kinds of things about people who are dead, or at least I do, but then some of them are alive. And what you were saying about the high school students reading your poem and coming up with theories, what is that like, and how does that affect how you write? What do you think about audience as you're writing?
Man, that is such a great question. Mm-hmm. I try during the process, whatever the process might be, to not think about the audience. My students ask me about this all the time, because if we completely eliminate the consideration of audience, then people might write things that feel maybe complicated for complicated sake, because you might get something out of it, but when else, the minute it goes down on the page, the minute I'm holding it in my hands right now, I'm holding the book, the minute it goes into the book, it's for someone who's not you. Mm-hmm. One of our local authors, Ted Sanders, an amazing author who also teaches it at the University of Illinois, made the point that no matter what, the minute you have a book, it's a group project. Right. It's a group project. It's so many fingers in the one pot. And I'm not going to say that is a bad thing, but it certainly changes a lot of that. So I don't think during the process, I think all that much about the audience. But when I put the book together, I definitely thought about it. All the poems that are very directly classically related are all in the third section, mm-hmm, partially because the thought was, I needed to convince you. If you came this far with me, maybe you're willing to come a little bit further, right? Yeah. And I think a lot of the first section is animal poems and natural scenes and things that might be easier, family considerations, things that might be easier for the reader. Not easier, but at least maybe more relatable. And then maybe that those considerations are, in fact, no different than the classical, you know, that it seems removed, but it's 100% happening all the time.
Could you talk a little bit more about the process of putting the book together?
Sure, absolutely.
What kinds of, what you were thinking about in terms of selecting poems, arranging poems, deciding on sections?
Absolutely. So the book originally, when I graduated from my MFA program here, many, many years ago, 2010, I had...
ancient times.
Much like forever ago.
Much like ancient Greece.
Yeah, no, it really is.
So you do relate to Homer.
I had a full manuscript that was required of me, and I put it in the binder that they make you do with all the formatting, and then it went into the library, and it's never to be seen again. And none of the poems really ever came out of it.
Until literary scholars of the future enter the archives.
Let's look at his crappy poems.
What could this possibly mean? Now, they'll derive all kinds of meaning from it.
They will. That's another talk about audience. Maybe that's really interesting. But once that was done, once the tether was cut, like from the university, I drifted aimlessly in a world of no meaning, no idea what to do. And that actually was a really good thing because I sort of started digging in from the ground up. So this book actually started with a crazy project, which was to write a poem for every fragment of Heraclitus. I believe Heraclitus, something like 144, 143 extant fragments that we still have. And I was like, well, yeah, sure, I'll write 143 poems.
Dang.
Right? And then I got to about 20 and was like, nope.
Yeah. Like, this is not a good idea as I thought it was.
Which is also a good project.
Right. Absolutely, absolutely. And I think maybe 8 of those I liked, and I think maybe like 4 made it into the book. But I think that project started me on the path of saying, this was my training. I did not train in English. I did not train in creative writing. In fact, never took a workshop until I was 26 years old. And my first workshop was a week-long workshop, like the Kenyan kind of workshop. We had one, the Juniper Summer Program at UMass. And I was the old man. Everyone else was young and virile.
Yeah, 26 is ancient.
No, it's so old. And then I didn't know anything about what anyone was talking about. I remember my first year in my MFA program, people were like, you haven't read Gertrude Stein, you haven't read Tender Buttons? And I'm like, I literally have no idea what you're talking about, you know. So it was actually maybe good for me because I had to like double time it, figure out all those things that those people had already been doing.
Well, writing at any level is a craft, and it's something you have to learn. And I sometimes teach with students, especially younger people, because they're into my genre. And, you know, a lot of what I'm telling them is, you know, you can have the greatest story or the greatest emotional thought in the world in your mind, but if you don't know how to express that in words that people can read and understand,
absolutely,
you're never going to get anywhere with it, much less published.
That's the hard part, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I always used to say that I was pretty good at beginnings and pretty good at endings, but it was those pesky middles. But it was really terrible at those pesky middles.
That's interesting, though, because when I think about the title of your book, like translations, I think about this process of constantly engaging with another language.
Absolutely.
And having to return to it.
Absolutely.
Over and over. And, yeah. And the fact that fixing something into one language is just temporary, like returning to it at another time will produce a different meaning.
And, oh, sorry. I was going to say, to be fair, some of the translation for this book is my parents. Was this the child of divorced parents? So I think anyone who's had that particular experience is used to translating. I think we translate from our partners, we translate from our parents, we translate from our friends. We don't know. We don't actually know what the hell talking about some of the time. But.
Well, can we hear another translation?
Another translation? Sure, absolutely. I was thinking, anecdotally, I like telling this story. Maybe even the year before, I can't remember years anymore, but my father got remarried to my stepmom, Nina, who's awesome. And he wrote a poem for their wedding. He wrote a poem. Okay, so I'm losing, right? I'm at the wedding. I'm losing it. Like, it was lovely. And the first thing he asked me is that he was worried that the poem wasn't very good. And I was like, Dad, I'm not going to critique your wedding poem. Like, I'm going to be like, I don't know why you broke the line there,
I'll
Dad.
Have notes after the ceremony.
I'm not really
enjambment,
sure.
Really?
Yeah, right. Your illusions were a little weak. So I was in for really briefly for the wedding, and I had to fly right back to teach. And I always write a poem when I fly because I'm kind of afraid to fly secretly. So wrote a poem called Flight that's very much in response to my father's sort of wedding poem. So
fantastic.
This is called Flight. What if my father's eyes, when he talks about his leaning tower, his anger, this long shared winter? What if I leave and can't see the iris of the world again? What if it wavers below and we lost just echo against the last flickering phantom of mass? Or if we suddenly break free of bonds and push from weighted lines like brief breath or air caught in the sky's long fluted throat, gray moat? What if I had never heard the sound of it? The wind shook dogwood of my father's grief. The fish once so impossible to give back to sea. Or how, after his hands unclenched, finally received, how they welcomed whatever this foolish boy offered, whatever whispered song in languages long dead.
Thank you.
You have a very good lyricism. I love that. Was it wind? Wind shook dogwood. That's an image that any country boy from around here is absolutely going to totally get the idea.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
I want to ask you kind of a strange question, but it's something that I often think as a reader, which is that, is it ever exhausting to be experiencing life and then to be thinking at the same time how that experience can turn into representation?
Absolutely, right? So that's the... you see, you have to live it twice, maybe? Yeah? I that's such a great question. I feel like maybe we talk to our students about this, or the students. Students are always asking this question. I'm always trying to shake people away from biography, honestly. Mm-hmm. Not because I was trained in as any sort of critic, but because it sometimes seems a little boring. I think when it comes down to it, especially in a first book, maybe biography is just how it goes. I was thinking about musical albums, and that first album is, yeah, you know, actually sort of about a breakup. That's or true. Something, and then after that...
Well, and, you know, every writer, a lot of writers, when they're starting, their hero, especially on your first novel, your hero is at least a projection somewhat of you, and especially with young writers, and that's how they identify, because they're trying to find ways to tell their stories.
Absolutely.
And I think you're absolutely right. You don't want to have biography. I think that can expose you to too much. But you take your own experiences and then you filter that through a different story or a different setting. But, you know, like I tell students, you know, you don't have to write a story about... You can write about what you know without writing about being a farm boy in Central Illinois. You Absolutely. Can be a farm boy on a planet far, far away.
Absolutely.
But the
Just
idea
like
is
Luke Skywalker.
Exactly.
Just
I, like Luke. I do bring some allusions to you.
No, it's absolutely true. And I think it's super interesting to think about. I mean, in terms of biography, I think students want to go out and kind of mess up their lives a little bit. And I'm like, oh, your lives are going to mess up.
Right.
Without any to do that. But I do think living it twice is a really interesting sort of problem, because you are going to sort of consider it. You're going to sit on it. You're going to think about what it might do in terms of a piece. So you have to sort of go through it all over again. But maybe there's some kind of, I hate to say catharsis to it, but, yep, but maybe there's a book you have to write. Mm-hmm.
So could you talk a little bit about how you write, what your process sure. is and sure. what?
It's changed a lot over the years. I think when I started, I was very much the classic sort of, I'm going to sit down at 2 o'clock in the morning with my Jameson and write. And now I'm super against that, actually.
Hashtag I am too, everyone's 20s.
Yeah. Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. What you can't see listening is
when you read your drunk writing sober, you sometimes go, oh,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. That famous misattributed sort of Hemingway quote, right, that you write drunk, but you edit sober, right? And which a student of mine has actually brought up in a paper recently, which I thought was super interesting. But in terms of my process now, it's... much more of a chiseling process. Mm-hmm. So I every day will write, almost every day, write a fairly large amount of just text, and then I'll chip away what doesn't make sense.
Fascinating. So, and poetry, yeah, that's a fascinating way to look at it too.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So maybe a little bit of sculpting in a weird way.
Right.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So what are you reading?
What am I reading?
And what have you read that shaped this book, too? If there's influences, maybe past influences, and then also present reading.
I can tell you for this book, lots of influences, but really anything by Carl Phillips. Carl Phillips is one of my all-time favorite poets, and he taught Latin for 10 years at the high school level, and so has a lot of training in classics, a lot of classical allusions in that. talked about things in some of his books that I was like, this is important. Like, I'm pretty sure he has a poem where he says that it was important once whether or not there were 6 or 12 birds in one quadrant of the sky. And like, someone might read that and say, yeah, maybe. But I'm telling you, no, it's important. I mean, for example, I'm pretty sure that's why Romulus kills Remus, because they disagree about the number of birds in the sky. And that's why it's not called Rem. Right, like that. Instead, we've got Rome, but you know. So it's sort of. But also, Kathy Graber, who's an amazing writer who works at VCU, wrote a book called The Eternal City, in which she has a series of poems, one for every book of Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, that are about her cleaning out her mother's garage and things after her passing. Mm. If there was anything I could ever do.
That's fascinating. And you're kind of getting at this a lot, is tying these classical ideas to regular life of the day. And nothing is more exemplary of that than to write about Marcus Aurelius in the setting of your cleaning out your mother's garage.
Absolutely.
It's brilliant. And, yeah. and it ties us to those past, you know, when people are worried about, you know, history and what humans were at different times. It makes it clear that we are the same people. And it ties us together both historically and across other lines.
No, right? Like, famously, famous is a consideration, but I think Kathy herself in the book says, you know, Aurelius, who fell in love with wisdom but was married off to duty instead, you know, and if I ever had an emotional reaction to Aurelius, that probably was the reason why. In fact, I've got an Aurelius, I've got a bunch of Aurelius stuff in here. I've got an Aurelius poem.
Yeah,
sort of ish, please. If you want to hear. So the background of this poem is called Homily. I went to a friend's wedding, friends who are classicists, who I had introduced. Thank you very much.
Matchmaker and poet.
Exactly, matchmaker and poet.
Yeah, 20 life points.
Love, Ren. And they asked me to read something. And I don't know if this is an apocryphal story, because I can't quite remember it correctly, but I believe they asked me to read some Aurelius at their wedding. And I was like, you know, 20 years of war and then dying of plague, maybe not the best thing at your wedding. So I don't remember what I read, but I do remember that this poem came out of it. So it's called Homily 1 in Pueblo, Colorado. The officiant, glasses propped against his forehead, said the cat he once had would sleep anywhere, on a book, a magazine, you, anything made of paper, anything made of anything. He named the small gray thing Marcus after his favorite philosopher. Marcus often found a way into and on top of his sermons. Aurelius once said, each person has but one life, and yours is almost finished. But you have to understand, he meant this in the kindest possible way. It was a harbor to him, an orlop, where each precious day that had passed could be stored like rigging, safe below the waterline. How quickly things disappear, both the things themselves and, in time, their memory. I confess, the rose on this boutonniere wasn't made of cloth. I watched it die in the midday heat, and in time I forgave myself. Each thing becomes another thing. This flower is the sleeping bride. This flower is the useless cufflinks. And this flower is the water fountain in the basement, where small paper funnels serve as cups or take the place of open hands. Everything of the soul is dream and smoke, and life is all warfare and a stranger's wandering. And the reward, oblivion. Water continues to spill on this filament carpet. Nothing can be done to save it. No one has ever thought to empty the reservoir.
Hmm. So you've been reading your poems in other places besides Weft. Yeah. Where have you been so far, and where are you headed?
A lot of great places. So I've been down to Eastern Illinois University, out to Franklin College in Indiana. Went to Kent for a week for the prize reading, where I got to read with Jane Hirschfield. And like 500 people showed up to this reading. And
did you high-five them all?
I really wanted to.
Or did you body surf?
No, right? Like, what I really wanted to do was stand up on the stage, because I read first, and take a selfie of myself.
Yeah.
And
put the whole crowd behind you?
Yeah, I didn't do that, because I figured maybe that was the most people I'd ever read to. But the greatest thing that happened is, I believe, more than one person came up to me while we were signing books. Jane Hirschfield and I were signing books afterwards for like 45 minutes, which hurts your hand. I never thought of this
before. Oh, I've been there.
Totally,
buddy.
Right? Yeah. Right. And then, but someone came up to me and was like, I was here to see Jane Hirschfield, but who the hell are you? Like, in this really positive way. And I was like, I'm the new guy.
New kid on the block.
I kind of love that. And but yeah, so Kent went to Knox out in Galesburg, mm-hmm. which was awesome because it's amazing out there. And also went over to Springfield and did a reading at the Vachel Lindsay House, which was really, really fun. And then next weekend, I'm actually going to be at the Louisiana Book Festival giving a talk about poems from the Southern Review that have been influential to my work, which means I'm probably going to talk about prose poems because I love prose poems.
Including the one that's in Poetry Daily is a prose poem, right?
Absolutely, it is a prose poem. Yeah, it's my new thing. In fact, the new manuscript, which I'm working on now, will be only prose poems.
Oh,
only
interesting. Poems.
No more of this lineated crap.
Yeah. Who's got time for that?
Exactly. Nobody.
Bursting free of the strictures. Of
done with you.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you asking.
Yeah, so no, of really course. Nice. It was lovely hearing your work, and I appreciate hearing what you have to say about your writing as well.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah.
Absolutely.
You have been listening to Smile Politely Radio. SmilePolitely.com is the place to go for all things local arts, culture, food and drink, music, opinion, tech, and more. To take us out, we are going to listen to Motes playing Fools. They are doing a benefit concert at Exile on Maine this Saturday. And I forgot to mention at the top of the show, we heard Single Player play Out of Control. They are headlining a show at Mike and Molly's at 9 o'clock on Sunday. So I think there's your weekend plans. All right, to take us out, let's hear Motes.